Hi everybody. The sound is good, right? You can hear? It's nice to be here. Thanks for coming. I recognize old friends. Not that you're so old. Old friends and new friends. Thanks for coming out and thank you for introducing me. But I'm also a grandfather now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I got 3 grandchildren. Yes. And as far as I know, I've never won any awards for my writing.
Spiritual writing.
Oh, best spiritual writing. Oh, really? Oh.
2003, taking our place.
Oh, well, thank you for letting me know. So I can say I'm an award-winning author. Yeah, right. Okay. Good to know, good to know. Well, so how are you all doing? Everybody's okay? Yeah? Nice to sit, right? Very nice. I want to talk about Buddha's teachings about friendship. So I have a talk prepared on that subject. And I was thinking about friendship lately. I have a lot of friends. Probably you do too. And it's precious. So I thought to myself, I wonder what the Buddha had to say about this. So once upon a time, Ananda asked the Buddha about friendship. He knew that having good and encouraging friends is a really important element of the path. And the more he thought about it, the more he realized it's really important. And he said to the Buddha, I bet having spiritual friendship is at least half of the path. And Buddha said, no, Ananda, having good friends is not half of the path. It's the whole of the path. It's the most important thing. One of my favorite suttas in the Pali Canon about friendship is the Magiya Sutta, which is in the Udana, one of the lesser known compendia of Buddhist texts. And it's kind of funny. Some of the suttas are quite funny. They're presented in very austere language, so you might not get that they're funny until you think about it. And this one, I think, is quite funny. Magiya is a very enthusiastic young meditator. And he was attending the Buddha one time on a journey, and they camped in a place, just the two of them, and Magiya found an especially impressive and inspiring mango grove, and he really wanted to go into that mango grove and meditate. So he asked the Buddha if he could do this, and the Buddha said, no, don't do that. Wait until someone comes to relieve you, and then go. And 3 times, with tremendous enthusiasm, Magiya asked the Buddha if he could do this, and finally the Buddha said, okay. So Magiya went into the beautiful mango grove to meditate, and it did not go well at all. He was shocked and amazed to find that when he sat down to meditate, his mind was a snarl of agitation. Malicious, lustful, and confused thoughts flooded his heart. And he scarcely could even notice the beauty of the mango grove. He was so obsessed with all these thoughts, and it just amazed him. He was surprised. He fully expected a peaceful, wonderful meditation. So he rushed back to the Buddha to report this amazing occurrence. It was so amazing to him. to find his mind so full of snarled, tangled, lustful, resentful thoughts. But the Buddha was not surprised at this result, and he took the opportunity to give some good teachings to Meghiya. He said to Meghiya, there are five things that will induce release of heart and lasting peace. First, a lovely intimacy with good friends. Second, a virtuous conduct. Third, frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. Fourth, diligence, energy, and enthusiasm for the good. And fifth, and finally, insight into impermanence. So he gave that little teaching to Meghiya, and then to benefit him even more, he repeated the same teaching twice more. Only the second and third times through, he preceded each member of the five-membered teaching with the first one. In other words, when there is a lovely intimacy between friends, then there will be virtuous conduct. When there is a lovely intimacy between friends, there will then be frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. When there is a lovely intimacy between friends, there will be eventually diligence, energy, and enthusiasm for the good. And when there is a lovely intimacy between friends, there will be insight eventually into impermanence, the fruition of the path. So I really appreciate this teaching more and more as time goes by, to be able to practice with good friends for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. This is really special, I can tell you. So much comes out of it. As you ripen and age, you appreciate the nobility and the uniqueness of each friend. And you appreciate the twists and turns that a life will take over many, many decades. And you appreciate the gift that each person has given you. After a while, if you get to be as old as I am, you find that you are all too frequently attending funerals of your dearest friends. And every loss seems to increase the gravity and the preciousness of your own life, and to make the friendships that remain even more important to you. And when long friendship with good people along the path of spiritual practice is a central feature of your life, it's almost impossible. Just like the Buddha says, for spiritual qualities conducive to awakening not to ripen, they just will. And for those on the Bodhisattva path, loving and appreciating your friends, even when they're difficult, as they so often are, is itself the path's fullness and completion. Because friendship over time ripens and deepens the capacity for compassion. These days, the word relationships is almost a buzzword. Many books are written about relationships and how to handle relationships. When you hear the word relationship, the first thing you think of is a romantic relationship. But relationships also might mean our connections with parents, with children, siblings, colleagues. But actually, the large and growing literature about relationship, I don't think features that much friendship per se. Yet, it could be that friendship is the most wonderful form of human relationship. Emerson has an essay on friendship. He calls friendship the masterpiece of nature. Isn't that a wonderful thought? Friendship is the masterpiece of nature. That we and our friend can, in midst of the cacophony of human relations, in the hall of mirrors that is every person's mind and heart, that we can, in the midst of all that, actually communicate intimately with one another, however much we might also misunderstand, and be for one another, come what may, support one another unselfishly. This really is a masterpiece of nature and one of our brightest human achievements. If you are discouraged at the what human beings have wrought on our poor, delicate planet Earth, think of friendship and how beautiful that is, and that weighs on the other side of the scale. Friendship is also really important when times are rough. Because when you're having a rough time, knowing you have a friend that you can really trust, that you can talk to, that can share the burden with you, makes a rough time much, much easier. And it can even be lovely and deepen the friendship to share at that level. In the Magiya Sutta and elsewhere, the Buddha is referring quite specifically to spiritual friendship. But I think that real friendship is always spiritual friendship. In his essay on friendship, Emerson writes, "The laws of friendship are great, austere, and eternal, of one web with the laws of nature and of morals. But we seek our friends not sacredly, but with an adulterated passion." In other words, he's coming around to saying that great as friendship is, most actual friendships fail. They don't come up to the potential. Because we're looking for something that we want to get from the other person. Entertainment, sympathy, support, unable to stand the fullness of the other. We don't want to discover and offer our own. Almost all people descend to meet, Emerson says. What a disappointment is actual society. In other words, this thing that's so great, the masterpiece of nature, we have in potential and we almost never exercise it. It's very disappointing. Human relations is very disappointing, especially when you recognize their potential. Real friendship, he writes, includes the depth of solitude of each one of us. A depth that most of us don't really want to go to. So he says, real friendship, when it happens, is something quite profound. Well, Emerson is an incredible idealist. I don't give ordinary, run-of-the-mill friendships quite such a bad rap as he does. I think it's pretty good to have a pal and a buddy. to come together out of mutual interest, out of attraction to one another for whatever reason, or just social necessity. Everybody needs a friend. We all need people to talk to and hang out with and play with. It's normal. It's healthy. There's some joy in it. And yes, I think we do care about one another. And yet, spiritual friendship, the friendship that Buddha called the whole of the holy life, and that Emerson considered the masterpiece of nature, this is something else again. In the Buddhist path, spiritual friendship takes place in the context of Sangha life. A life built on teaching, dedicated practice, and on a shared commitment to going beyond self-interest and personal need. So spiritual friendship is really less about personal connection than it is about helping one another to grow in faith and goodness, to realize, as we say in Zen, our true nature. Sangha friendships are forged and grounded in silence, especially in our tradition in Soto Zen, where emphasis is placed on practice as a shared activity over many decades. Sangha friendship is central. It's one of the pillars of our practice. In ordinary friendships, we might connect right away with lots to share and learn from one another. But in Sangha life, usually, friendship develops much, much more slowly. Maybe it takes years before you ever share backgrounds and personal stories. Or maybe you never do. In the meantime, we're slowly getting to know one another intimately in the silent space of the meditation hall. We get to know each other's hands and feet and facial expressions. We get to know each other's walking and standing and sitting. We see the suffering and the triumph expressed in body language and facial expression. We hear the sound of our voices joined together in chanting, our groans, our fatigue, the ways we cope when we have very little of our usual social strategies available to us on the fourth or fifth day of intense session, or toward the end of a 90-day training period when everybody's so exhausted they're walking around like zombies. You really get to know people then. And I don't know about your Sangha here, but I know from my experience, the unlikeliest people show up in Buddhist Sanghas, at least in Zen Sanghas. People who under ordinary circumstances would never meet, much less spend weeks, perhaps years at a time, intimately together. And yet this disparate group of people manages to find harmony and commonality and deep mutual appreciation despite their many differences. They come to share something more fundamental, more basically human than their interests and affinities. It happens. It's not too unusual to be sharing Sangha life with someone who pushes all your buttons and just gets your goat every time. Exactly the sort of person that if you had a choice, you would avoid this person at all costs. You would never, ever be involved with such a person. The person who is exactly like your father. or your brother, or the person who betrayed you in high school, you know, that person inevitably ends up sitting next to you in the Zendo, in a retreat, in a practice period. And with the encouragement of the teachers and teaching and Sangha, you are going to have to deal with this person in ways that you never would left to your own devices. And eventually, this person too becomes a valued friend and heals your life in ways you never would have expected. Emerson and Buddha share the perspective that spiritual friendship requires two elements: truthfulness and tenderness. Spiritual friends are honest with one another. They have courage, they take risks, they speak from the standpoint of truthfulness, not just expediency or niceness. When my friend goes astray, at least as far as I can see, I have to speak up. And I expect the same from him as well. That's one thing that good friends can do for one another. Yet tenderness is equally and simultaneously important. Dogen writes of the power of kind speech. Speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby, with that much tender love and sweetness, he says. So a true friend's criticism is given with loving kindness because it comes from a loving heart seeking only my benefit and well-being. And if I find I'm lacking in tenderness, speaking what I consider to be truth out of defensiveness or annoyance or some sense of separation, I have to know this, and I have to work on healing those causes within myself of this breach of kindness and keep my peace until I'm ready to speak to my friend with love. We think of spiritual teachers as a kind of parental figures, authority figures. Maybe nowadays we think of them as kind of coaches or trainers or almost like therapists. But in Mahayana Buddhism, teachers are referred to as kalyanamitas, spiritual friends, people who see us as we are, love us anyway, and care absolutely for our ultimate welfare. And the teacher's job is to model spiritual friendship. When at first we might be intimidated by the teacher, imagining him or her to be far more spiritually developed than we are, as time goes on, the teacher transforms from a scary boss to a trusted friend. And over time in Sangha life, we come to have many such inspiring friendships, not only with our teachers, but also with many others who will support and love us in the same way. No matter the person, of whatever background or personal style, anyone with enough proximity in sincere practice over time becomes a Sangha friend, a true Sangha friend, whom you will treat with full respect and affectionate regard, and who will treat you the same. The Buddha thought that Sangha was that, a harmonious group of spiritual friends looking out for one another's welfare, living together with full equality for the purpose of the spiritual development of each one. And the early Buddhist Sangha was radical in its insistence that anyone high-born person, low-born person could join and be fully accepted and equally loved. Rank was established solely on the basis of ordination seniority, without regard to wealth, social position, or even skill in practice. And to this day, the Buddha Sangha retains this emphasis on equality and inclusion. To be sure, the ideal wasn't and isn't always practiced perfectly. As everyone knows, women were included, but never included as equals with men. Even now, even today in Asian Buddhisms. And in contemporary Western Buddhist sanghas, the populations are overwhelmingly made up of white, middle-class, educated people. One can't help but notice. We hope it'll change. We're doing whatever we can to change it, and maybe it will someday, I hope so. But it's definitely going to take a long time, and it will require the availability of many teachers of color, both men and women. Still, even as things stand right now, we can rejoice in the wholesomeness and inclusivity of our Sangha friendships, and we can depend on them to support us in hard times. Sometimes you might expect or ask for more emotional or material support from Sangha than we seem to be getting. Sometimes people are disappointed, you know, expecting more. But the more we are established in the practice, and the more we really see the Dharma and take responsibility in it, the more we will understand that the support Sangha provides is the most fundamental and the most healing kind of support. Simple, gentle encouragement to awaken. So now I'll tell you a little Zen story. This is the 78th story in the Blue Cliff Record, a famous collection of Zen stories. Once upon a time, there were 16 bodhisattvas. And when it was time for the monks to wash up and take a bath, the bodhisattvas filed into the bathhouse to bathe. Suddenly, all together and all at the same time, they awakened. They awakened to the basis of water. All you Chan worthies, how will you understand their saying? Subtle feeling reveals illumination, and we have achieved the station of sons of Buddha. So these 16 bodhisattvas all together awakened while taking a bath when they felt the touch of the water on their skins. Good story, don't you think? In big public Chan monasteries in the old days, they didn't have such a thing as a private bathroom. They had a big common bathhouse where everybody went to bathe and use the toilet. And there would be a certain time of day on the schedule for bath time, and everybody would file into the bathhouse and take a bath in some big, gigantic bathtub, which we still do in our monastery at Tassajara. Happens to be located in a place with hot springs. So it's really great, the bath time, especially in the winter when it's cold and there's not much heat. That hot springs water is pretty welcome. And we would have bath time in the late afternoon after the work period, and before the evening service and dinner, so we'd come in and wash off all the dust from the day's work and get all cleaned up and put on our robes for service and dinner. When you enter the bathhouse, you bow at the shrine and you recite the verse for bathing. And enshrined on the bathhouse altar is a picture of the 16 bodhisattvas. Then you enter the bath, and the bathing period is in silence. And then you put on your robes, and by the time you're done, you hear the densho bell sounding for the evening service. This story of the 16 bodhisattvas is the only Buddhist story that I am aware of. There probably are others, but it's the only one I know of in which 16 people realize awakening simultaneously together as good spiritual friends. Sitting chest deep in the tub, they must have looked around at one another with beautiful smiles of acknowledgement, saying, no doubt, absolutely nothing. Mostly we think of awakening as an individual affair. And the scriptures, you know, the sort of mythical story of the Buddha makes it sound like this. But really, it's not like that. You know, we practice together, we awaken together, we understand together. Together, we go forth to do what needs to be done. Mahayana Buddhist teachings fully recognize that it makes no sense that there could be such a thing as individual awakening. The Bodhisattva clearly sees that no individual could be truly happy or content while others are suffering. No one can be happy, no one can be enlightened, unless everyone is happy and enlightened. The self and other are not two different, truly existing entities. They are mutually conditioning positions, concepts. What we call a person, what we think of as ourself, is in reality a series of interactions and relationships with the world in which we are of necessity embedded. There is no such thing as an atomized, freestanding person. A person floating around in space is an impossibility. This is completely obvious to bodhisattvas. And that's why love, compassion, and friendship are absolutely at the center of the bodhisattva path. And the Buddha of the coming era, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha was the Buddha of this era. The Buddha of the coming era is Maitreya, who is the Buddha of friendliness. In his essay on friendship, Michel de Montaigne, the 16th century French essayist, compares friendship to all other human relationships, and he finds it far superior. Siblings usually fight with one another, he says. Spouses are emotionally entangled, too much so to support one another disinterestedly. Parents and children are blinded by the psychological weight of their connection. They could never see one another with fully open appreciation. But friends, he writes, share one mind, one heart, one will. They are for one another, he writes, even more than a person can be for herself. One can trust one's friends to look after one's interests more than one can trust yourself, he writes. Nothing is more intimate, nothing more lovely than friendship. So writes Montaigne. And his essay on friendship is all the more poignant because at the end of the essay, he tells us that he's not just theorizing. He's writing in testimony and memorial to the most cherished friendship of his own life, his relationship with the writer Estienne de la Boitie, whose death has left him feeling, as he writes, like half a person. So this struck me because in my talk this evening, I'm doing the same thing. I'm talking in testimony and memorial to my own dear friend of more than 40 years, Rabbi Alan Liu, who passed away all of a sudden on January the 12th, 2009. I met him on the first day of classes at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1968. He was not a rabbi, I was not a Zen student. We were writers together. We both finished the program at Iowa, and we moved independently to California, and in California we resumed our friendship and eventually practiced Zen together for about a decade under our teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman. And through a series of weird coincidences that would make you believe in God, Alan became a rabbi. And we continued our spiritual friendship. We even founded a Jewish meditation center together in San Francisco that is still in operation. Even though he's gone, I'm continuing with that center. And many of our students in that center have been around in his days too. So for more than 40 years, Alan supported, loved, and respected me more than I supported, loved, and respected myself. And his practice and loving heart was and remains a tremendous inspiration to me. In his essay, Montaigne argues that this kind of deep friendship, as he understands it, is necessarily exclusive. He says it's only possible to have one such dear friend, and that the exclusivity of this friendship is its essence. But this isn't the case with spiritual friendship. We have many dear, deeply dear spiritual friends, and having one doesn't impact the other. Probably the more friends we have, the more we're capable of having, and the more enriched our lives become. Still, with luck, maybe we do have, as I've had, a spiritual relationship that is uniquely precious to us. It was actually one of the features of our friendship that it was not exclusive. Whenever we were involved in deep conversation, if somebody else came along, we just included them. We didn't say, go away, we're special together, we don't want to talk to you. No, we always included everybody who was around. And that encouraged other people to form friendships as well. And I think spiritual friendship is like this. It never depends on division or exclusivity or discrimination between people, because real love cannot be exclusive. It's boundless, it's empty, it's open, and it's free, like spiritual friendship. No doubt this is an impossible ideal, but I believe that it was what the Buddha had in mind when he taught that there is no element of the path more precious or more important than spiritual friendship. It's funny, late yesterday, I actually went to visit Alan's grave. He's buried in Colma, just south of San Francisco. And it was, I haven't been there in a while. And it was, you know, today is the second day of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Yesterday was the first day. So the Jewish cemetery was closed, which was nice, because I could get in anyway. I could sort of go over the fence. And nobody else was there. It was very peaceful. A lot of Jews buried in San Francisco for the last several hundred years. Big cemetery. Somehow or other, I knew exactly the way to get there, far up on the hill. Very poignant. Sun was shining, a beautiful day. Very sad. Miss my friend. And we just had recently a death in our everyday Zen Sangha in the Bay Area. Herman Claussen. Remember Herman? Yeah. Yeah, he just died. Herman got Parkinson's disease. Did you know this? Yeah, he had Parkinson's and he had a very bad case of it. So it completely, Parkinson's disease can like shut down your whole body. So you can't talk, you can't move, nothing, you know. So he got to be in that shape. But he was always, somehow or other, he managed to be cheerful. You realize that he was an extraordinary person that way. Anyway, I bring it up because he didn't have a family. He was born in Germany during World War II. And he didn't have any family left. So it was a wonderful thing the way the Sangha surrounded him with love and care in his last days and took care of everything for him and chanting for him and being there when he died and after he died and washing his body and taking care of everything. Beautiful. I think everybody so appreciated that they could do that, which they wouldn't have been able to do maybe if he had had four children, that would be their thing to do, right? So in a way it was extra special. And then just a few nights ago we had an evening with some friends that we have known since we began our practice in the early 1970s. Keith and Leslie, you know them, yeah. And it's kind of great because we don't see them very often, right? Like they said, the last time we spent an evening together was like 6 years ago, something like that. We see them, you know, in passing once in a while. But here's people we've been practicing with, even though different places, right, for 45 years or more. And it makes no difference whether we see each other. Our hearts are totally connected. So when we do see each other, there's so much to share, there's so much trust there. We don't need more, you know. So this is a wonderful thing, this spiritual friendship that I'm talking about. It's really a blessing, and it comes from the practice. Because something in your heart is activated by the practice. And when there are others whose hearts have been touched in just that same way, it's as if your hearts resonate together. And when you come together and know each other based on that, it's something really, really wonderful. You don't need make a big deal out of it. In fact, it's not a big deal, but it's really, really great. So maybe because of all these things having happened lately, this was on my mind, spiritual friendship. But it's very important, right? To practice together with people. That's the only way we practice. I think the Buddhist movement tends to be too much people thinking, it's my practice for me. But I don't think so. Anyway, that's what I wanted to tell you. So why don't you just take just 5 minutes or 6 or 7 minutes, something like that. And everybody can find one person to talk to right nearby where you're sitting. And why don't you just have a conversation with that person and tell them, if you will, if you're willing, tell them about one person who's your friend and how you came to know that person and what they mean to you. However you define friend, however you think of it. Would you do that? I think that'd be nice. So why don't everybody find somebody, and then I'll ring a bell and stop you after about 6 or 7 minutes, and then we can see whatever what else we have to say. Well, we have a little time to see what's on your mind or what you'd like to share. Maybe you just said something or heard something that seemed worth sharing with everyone. So what do you think?
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability, yeah, is important in friendship, isn't it? Yeah, right. Being willing to open yourself up, yeah. And that means being willing to be hurt, being willing to care enough, yeah. Reminds me of when my friend Alan and I were first friends, it's a long time ago, and I remember once he was very troubled and he wanted to talk to me, and I said, what do you want to talk about? And he explained to me that I had hurt his feelings. And in those days, like, guys didn't tell other guys that they hurt their feelings, you know what I mean? It's like, what? I hurt your feelings? What feelings? You know? we've come a long way since then, but I remember that impressed me. I said, wow, you know? First of all, that he had feelings impressed me. And that I could hurt his feelings, that would surprise me. I had no idea that I had hurt his feelings. And then, even more surprising, that he would say so. And of course, I was very sorry, and you know, I had no idea. And he explained it to me, and I apologized. And so, vulnerable, yeah.
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 The difference, I could say, is the amount of courage that I have here when I started practicing at Tim, to look into deep places here.
Yeah.
I didn't have it when I was by myself.
Yeah, you really need support for that, right? You really do. Yeah, even if you don't talk to other people, just yeah. With people around, it holds it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that of necessity, we don't have places to sit together every day, a lot of times, and so we sit alone. But I think it's really important to sit with other people for that reason and other reasons too. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's just a pleasure, I think, and an important experience to have, to know that you're sitting in a room full of people who probably also have had some suffering in their lives and are willing to look at it. Because everybody has some suffering in their lives, but a lot of people are not willing to look at it or willing to admit that it's true. Everybody's looking around at everybody else thinking, I'm the only one who's a mess, and I'm not going to let them know that. And they're all thinking the same thing, you know. When you come in here, we all know we're a mess. You know what I mean? It's clear. You wouldn't be here if you didn't like weren't a wreck, you know. So then it's nice to know, okay, it's I can be safe here, you know. Right. Yeah. That's the dirty secret about being human. It's a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for asking us to talk about our friends. I'm surprised at the friend that came up for me to share. We push each other's buttons so much. I've hurt her feelings, she's hurt mine. And yet, the reason that she came up is when I often am needing some wisdom, her voice is there.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of gratitude for it.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah. Sometimes it's like that. We rub shoulders with each other, you know. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. And how come you talk to the person? Just it happens, or you make your mind up to approach them and say something, or what happened? How does that happen?
Yeah, I just get bored in the grocery store.
I wonder if the clerks in the store think, oh, here comes that lady who's always chatting up everybody.
The
think about it, by far the vast majority of people all over the world are basically pretty decent and are kind to one another. Because imagine a world in which people were not that way. They didn't stop at red lights because they didn't feel like stopping at red lights. They stole things from anybody that they felt like stealing things from. You know, I mean, that's the way the world would be, but actually most people are not that way. People are law-abiding and relatively, so that we can live in relative safety, even though these abstractions, political abstractions, are so disturbing. In fact, most people are decent. So it's a blessing. Yeah, and to try to extend that, right? As you're saying, to communicate more and try to make more connection. I think that does change the world. Right? To reach out to anybody and everybody and not think that somebody you look at you is not your friend. To assume everybody is your friend because they're human and they're just like you, right? So that's, to have that attitude and live it is what we need to do. I think when enough of us are living like that, in that way, extending that basic kindness, then it'll be a better world. But certainly one feels better doing that, right? You feel better. It's better for you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've had the rare privilege of experiencing being a global citizen. Mm-hmm. Finding language almost makes no difference.
Mm-hmm.
And friendships, very often with distance, creates an intimacy when there's a true desire for one and mm-hmm. safety in it. But there's something I've discovered lately that it's such a new thing. I don't quite know where it's going, but I'm very excited. And that is the friendship with grandchildren.
Yes.
And I have 4 under the age of 3.
Oh, wow.
Master teachers.
Yeah.
And to just be open and present and see what comes there is a whole different kind of friendship.
Yeah. It's very sweet. Do your grandchildren live around here?
No. But yeah. I like your friends.
Yeah, my grandchildren don't live near where I live either. That's too bad. I also have to fly a long distance to see them, but yes. It's a special relationship, isn't it? It's really wonderful. Yeah, because you're not the responsible one, right? So you can. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, isn't that a great phrase, the masterpiece of nature? I'm guessing that there isn't anybody who said, and tell me if I'm wrong, that there isn't anybody who said, I don't really have a friend I care about that much that ever illuminated my life. Was there anybody who said that? Everybody probably had. I'm guessing, right? Everybody probably had. At least one person that came to mind, like the one you're describing. So it's an interesting thought, isn't it, that probably almost everybody has something like that in their life, but who thinks about it? Usually you don't think about it, right? Because you have problems, you've got traffic, or you've got to go to the store, or something is happening, that, you know. So in other words, it just goes to show you that it's worth noticing when your mind is disturbed that you could intentionally remember your friend, right? And cheer yourself up. Or something that is really worthwhile in your, that's actually in your life, except it's a funny thing that afflictive and negative emotions are far more attractive to us than positive emotions, even though we like the positive emotions better. But when you get a you know, something that bothers you, that tends to take over your entire attention, and you forget about all the things that are going on in your life that are kind of wonderful. You forget about all that, and you're obsessed with this one thing that's the problem. So it's kind of an interesting thought to notice next time your mind is running down with something that's wrong or that isn't working right or that upsets you or bothers you, to stop yourself and think whether you can think of something that's also in your life equally that is worthwhile and wonderful. Like, for example, you're not sick. You know, you're pretty healthy in this moment. And but you don't think about that, right? You think, oh, how come this person said that to me, and why is she doing that, and all that? And then you don't think, well, wait a minute. She, yes, that's true. She said that, and that is annoying. But on the other hand, I feel great. I'm happy. I just had a fantastic lunch. It was really good. You know, like, why? How come I'm so thinking about that only? So it's nice to spend an evening thinking about friendship. It's a pleasant thing, isn't it? It's nice, yeah. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you back there, yeah.
I'd like to ask you about Maitreya.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maitreya is a friend.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about the significance of Maitreya and why it's future?
Yeah. Well, this is one of my thoughts about this. And I'm not a scholar and a person who marshals evidence. So all my thoughts are half-baked. But I don't mind sharing my half-baked thoughts. And by the way, I'm absolutely convinced of all my half-baked thoughts. Just like everybody, right? So I think that about something like maybe right around the year, what we would call the first year, and now it's 2017, so right around the year one, right around there, something came over human beings. A big change of heart came over human beings, and human beings began to see, there'd be kind of a big feeling of love and recognition that we were past the stage of warring tribes, you know, that everybody not in my clan was a threat and I should, you know, be paranoid of them and kill them before they kill me. I think we were like that for a long time, and then at some point we realized, no, we have to get beyond that. Now we really see that it's essential to what we are as human beings to have universal kindness and universal love. And so I think that that thought came in many places at the same time among human beings, and to some extent they shared it and so forth. And I think it resulted in rabbinical Judaism and Christianity, which preached universal love, radical teaching at the time. And I think the same thought appeared in Buddhism as Mahayana Buddhism. And I think that all those traditions, and I'm assuming that something like that is in Islam, although I'm unfortunately really ignorant about Islam, so I don't know, but I'm assuming that there too. And so all these traditions proposed that we were going to go to that place eventually where there would be universal compassion, and that the task of religious life was to get us there. And so I think that then Buddhism proposed a coming time in which that would be characterized by universal love and friendliness. And that's why Maitreya Buddha is coming in the future. It's like the millennium. It's like the coming of the Messiah in Judaism, or the kingdom of God arriving on earth in Christianity. So I think that's like a tremendously powerful human dream that we all share. And even when you look at the world and it looks like, my God, it's going in exactly the opposite direction, I don't think it is at all. I think it's the most natural thing in the world is that there are backlashes, right? When we're changing, when human beings are changing, and it's a big change to be caring about others who are not our relatives, right? So that's a change in who we are as a human being. When those changes are becoming apparent, there's always backlashes. So you can see a lot of what's going on now as backlashes. But I think that, you know, like even I would love to go, you know, the soldiers have like, you know, like West Point or war colleges where they, the theory of war. And I would like to go to one of those war colleges because I'm guessing that the smartest people in armies all over the world, especially here in the United States, are teaching that war is no longer a viable option. We keep proving this over and over and over again, right? War is not a viable option. It simply does not do the work that we expected it to do. We conquer somebody, we get their territory, and everything is fine. It doesn't work that way anymore. So in other words, we're really outgrowing socially, spiritually, intellectually. We're outgrowing, we're growing toward. So that's why Maitreya Buddha is in the coming in the future at a time when it's another era, another eon of human dwelling on earth. So I think we should all share that dream, right, and have that, and have confidence in that. And I don't think it happens in my lifetime or your lifetime or maybe the lifetime of anybody sitting here, but I think we're getting there. After all, it's only been 2017 years. It's not very long. It takes a long time to get something like this going, right? Don't you think? Universal love, 2,000 years is nothing. 2,000 years goes by pretty fast. It does. So that's why. That's my half-baked idea. Maybe one last thing, if there is one last thing.
We looked at each other and I realized that both of us held that image of this woman with just joy.
Yes.
Like that friendship is not just like about acceptance of the person, but like cherishing
right.
Who they are, even
right, exactly.
Even when it's who they are.
Exactly. Right, so yes, if you look with eyes of love, even something that's objectionable looks beautiful, right? Or can look beautiful anyway, yeah. That's very sweet. Yes, I know. Sometimes I have a number of friends who, when they get sick, they're like that, you know, barking orders. Somebody goes to help them and volunteers to help them and they say, I'm never going back there again. Well, thank you everybody for being here. It's really sweet to see everybody. And we're going to, I guess there's still room for you to show up if you want to show up for the weekend.